Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to On the Ball with Rick Bucher. Here's your host.
Let's send it over to Rick Bucher.
Rick Bucher.
This is On the Ball on the United WeCast Network, and I am Rick Bucher. You can see me on FS1, hear me on Fox Sports Radio, and you can read me on the Fox Sports app and at foxsports.com. You can also follow me on X, the former Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at Rick Bucher. I'm a lot of places. But there's only one place you can hear me talking about story angles and perspectives that you are not likely to find anywhere else, primarily but not exclusively involving the NBA, and that is here. I don't know how many of my listeners were part of the chorus suggesting that Golden State Warriors coach Steve Kerr either A, should be fired, or B, is a wildly overrated coach who should be fired. But I hope there were none. Or at least a very small number that were simply dealing with neurological problems at the time and have since recovered and are chagrined at anything they might have said or done while ill. Because thinking that Kerr should be fired, or that he doesn't know how to coach, or that he is somehow underutilizing the Warriors this season, is the clearest sign that someone has no idea what coaching is all about. And I like to think of my listeners as being a little more lofty than that, a little more intelligent, a little more astute than that. And I'm not saying, never mind coaching an NBA team, I'm talking about just basic coaching. It also requires ignoring everything he has done since taking over as the Warriors head coach. Yes, Mark Jackson provided him a team with a foundation that did not exist before Jackson came to Golden State. Trust me, I've had a front row seat for this franchise for the last 25 years. The madness of Don Nelson, first and second time. The Keith Smart year. I was the sideline reporter for the team for the 2 years that Jackson was head coach. So I literally had a front row seat at those games, on the plane and in the locker room. I saw how Mark challenged Stephen Curry and Klay Thompson, how Jarrett Jack and Carl Landry and Richard Jefferson and Brandon Rush mentored them and refused to let the Warriors think of themselves as the same old Warriors, transforming them from the gimmicky mentality instilled by Nelly's unorthodox approach to a team built on basics, defense, hard work, offensive execution, and just pure grit. In hindsight, though, I don't know if Mark could have taken them to the next level. Mark was a much more accomplished player than Kerr was, and his player ego could still rear its head. It's one of the elements that created conflicts between him and the front office and ownership. He was sensitive to who was giving him advice or suggestions. If they weren't on his level, or he didn't think they were on his level, or he thought he was being disrespected in some way, he made it apparent. Being a devout Christian and being steadfast that homosexuality was a sin, with a team president and Rick Welts at the time that was gay, certainly didn't help either. Whatever ego Kerr has, on the other hand, it's tied to his belief that he understands what it takes to compete at the highest level and win championships. And that ego has been earned. Why shouldn't he think that way? He was part of 5 championship teams as a player, 3 with Chicago and 2 with San Antonio. And if you take a closer look at those teams, the Bulls and Spurs had 2 completely different systems, giving Kerr a chance to see what the common intangibles were that made champions. What made championship teams above and beyond whatever they ran, the X's and O's? Because here's the reality. And again, this may be something that most of you do not know. The X's and O's, everybody knows them. Everybody has them. The key is, can your team execute those? And it is on the coach to make sure that his team is capable or utilizing plays that he can be confident that his players can execute. But make no mistake, there's not any secrets in the NBA and there's not any voodoo magic to out-of-bounds plays or offensive sets or even defensive sets. It's simply a matter of how well a team can execute them and do they have the personnel to execute them in a particular way? And can the coach choose the correct systems to run? But basically when it comes down to whatever he chooses, it's not the decision between 2 systems that makes the difference between a winning team. It's how well they're executed. And with the 2 Spurs titles coming 4 years apart, you could make the case that he was actually part of 3 different championship systems in that those San Antonio teams were so vastly different. The nucleus of the first iteration was Tim Duncan, David Robinson, Sean Elliott, and Avery Johnson. The second was the start of the Duncan, Manu Ginobili, and Tony Parker run. Different nucleus, different way of playing, different strengths and weaknesses. Now, winning rings as a player in no way means someone knows what it takes to coach a championship team. Just because you know how a team that can win it all is supposed to play or prepare or think or act doesn't mean you have the capability of getting people who haven't been part of a championship team to play, prepare, think, and act in the necessary manner. Or make all the other thousands of everyday decisions required to guide a team through all the ups and downs, all the turmoil that every team experiences through the course of 100 plus games and 7 plus months of competition and essentially living with each other over that time. But Kerr has done that. 4 times he's done that. And again, with 3 differently constructed Golden State Warriors teams. It might have been 5 times, except for something completely out of his control, which were injuries to Kevin Durant and Klay Thompson. But he didn't just do it 4 times. He spent 2 years developing young talent. You know, the thing that I hear he doesn't know how to do because James Wiseman didn't pan out and Jonathan Kuminga and Moses Moody haven't been given the same playing time other lottery picks in their draft class have. He developed young talent into another championship squad. He turned Andrew Wiggins into a winning player. He got the most out of the wild child that is Jordan Poole. He made capable players out of Damian Lee and Gary Payton II, something their previous coaches couldn't or simply didn't. Kerr is in no way perfect. One of the special aspects of Steve as a coach is that he will readily tell you that. He will own up to when he makes a mistake. And if you sound, well, okay, so what's the big deal? Take a look around. Listen to some post-game interviews. How many coaches will you hear that will take it on themselves? I should have done something different. That one's on me. He'll own up to game situations where maybe he should have tried something different. But the immense respect that the Warriors have for him, the Warriors players, for anyone questioning if he has it or still has it, was demonstrated in Toronto. The team had travel issues just recently. The team had travel issues and didn't get in until 8 a.m. the day of the game. And they then looked like it at the start. The Raptors took a 14-7 lead. Doesn't sound like it's all that much. but the Warriors committed three turnovers, missed six shots at the rim in the first 5 minutes. Kerr called a timeout. He lit into them as they were coming back to the bench, refusing to accept his team sleepwalking. He wasn't going to wait until it was 40 to 15 or whatever it was headed toward. He didn't like, and it wasn't score. It wasn't the scoreboard. He doesn't coach by the scoreboard. He coaches by how his team is playing. And what he saw was a team that was ready to say, you know what? We had trouble. We got in late. We got him in early in the morning. It's not our day. Let's just get through this. He wouldn't allow them to do that. Because he has a standard that he has upheld with this team. And two, because he knows where they are in the battle for placement in the postseason. I don't see them getting out of the play-in at this point, but be a big difference if they're hosting a game versus they have to go on the road twice during the play-in in order to get there. So it took a minute and another Stephen Curry turnover to turn it around, but turn it around, the team did. They responded, and they ended up winning. Now, a lot of the criticism of Kerr recently has been spawned by the flameout of James Wiseman, the slow growth of Jonathan Kuminga and Moses Moody, and the Warriors not being the same dominant Warriors. The idea being that Kerr should have been playing Kuminga and Moody more and failed to make something out of Wiseman before he was traded to Detroit. But if Wiseman, let's follow that thinking for a second. If Wiseman had been shackled by Kerr, if he didn't realize what Wiseman could be, shouldn't he be going off in Detroit? I mean, come on, worst team in the league, young team. Opportunity galore there. If he's a talent, or he was a talent, just waiting to be unleashed, why can't he get on the floor for the worst team in the league for more than 14 minutes a game, which is 7 minutes less than Kerr played him his rookie year? That's where the idea that, well, see, Kerr spoiled him. Kerr didn't develop him when he needed to, and now it's too late. Get out of here. Wiseman was far from, he wasn't even a beginning project. He played three games in college and didn't play his second year in the league at all. He was raw can get. And yet, Kerr played him more as a rookie than he's playing right now in Detroit. And this is what everyone has to understand about Kerr. This is actually, and I should have said it at the start, this is what inspired me to do this podcast. Because to understand how a coach operates, whether you like him, you don't, whether you agree with him, whether you don't, if you want to understand where his thinking comes from, it goes back to what I said in the previous podcast about all of us being shaped by our experiences. Kerr, in order to survive in the league, had to learn how to maximize his physical abilities to stay in it. He was undersized, wasn't particularly quick. And the one thing he could do is he could shoot it. And he understood the game. And so he found a way to take everything that he had and mold it into something that could be valuable for great teams. He did that by being smart and efficient, understanding who he was and who he wasn't. He saw that truly great teams were made up of smart, efficient players, top to bottom. You didn't have great, talented players who were dumb or didn't know how to play or didn't know how to fit into the system. You can see where I'm going here. He saw that truly great players had extraordinary athletic ability, ability superior to his, and they were smart and efficient. They didn't cheat the game or take shortcuts. Have those of you, and this is where I was going, have those of you who think Kuminga should have been playing all this time ever just isolated on him over the course of a game? You don't even have to do it for the whole game. Just do it for one of his stretches on the floor. Not even a quarter. 5-6 minutes. Look at nothing else but Kuminga, if the TV cameras allow. If you're in person, if you have the discipline, don't watch the game, just watch Kuminga. Defensively, he still isn't always in the right place and looks completely unsure of exactly where he's supposed to be. And this is a Kuminga that we're seeing now that I now have cautious optimism can be a good, really good player. This, I forget what, people comparing him to Giannis. I mean, can we stop? Why do we do this? It's not fair to the player. He's just getting his feet wet. He's just starting to show he can play a little bit. And we want to compare him to a league MVP and a guy who led a team to a championship. That's insane. As I said, defensively, he still isn't always in the right place. Can't say that about Giannis. And as a result, Kuminga gets caught in no man's land a lot. Not Giannis. I'm going to just stop. I'm going to stop even mentioning Giannis' name because Giannis' name and Kuminga's name should not be ever mentioned in the same sentence for the foreseeable future. As far as offense with Kuminga, he can certainly be dynamic if he's directly involved in the play. But there are plenty of possessions where he's just standing, watching, not sure what to do. I imagine, you're never going to, by the way, you're never going to get him in the off-the-ball cuts that you see with Clay, with Steph, all of those guys being orchestrated. That's why the idea of running him with Chris Paul made a whole lot of sense. Chris Paul can make all the decision-making. He can get the ball to Kuminga no matter what he's doing or where he is. Now, imagine the Kuminga acolytes will point, or they may, point to his performance against the San Antonio Spurs the other night and suggest that's what the Warriors have been missing out on all this time. Kuminga was 10 for 17 for 26 points and 30 minutes. Sort of out of desperation, that basically Draymond and Chris Paul were like, you go, fella. Go try to get it. Now, there were only a couple problems. One, in spite of those numbers, Warriors lost. Two, he also had three measly rebounds in 30 minutes as the Warriors got smacked on the boards, 49-39, by a Spurs team playing without Victor Wembanyama and playing at home. He also picked up two silly fouls down the stretch as the Warriors tried to make a comeback. One in the backcourt when the Warriors were not pressing, and the other near midcourt when he just didn't have any body control and stumbled into Trey Jones. And this was a game, make no mistake, that the Warriors played through Kuminga a lot. The only other person who touched the ball more was Klay Thompson. Kuminga had the ball in his hands more than Draymond Green and Chris Paul combined, and yet he only had two assists to their combined 13. Now, the other young gun taken in the same draft class, Moses Moody, he's had a couple of things working against him. I am with those who feel like, man, I wish he was getting more minutes. I think he deserves them. And Steve has conceded that, yeah, he probably does. And it seems like those minutes are now ramping up. But the reason that he hasn't or didn't early on is it was simply a numbers game. It's the position that he plays. Kerr had other better choices for what he needed at various times. It was tough for him to get run with Curry, Clay, Jordan Poole, Otto Porter Jr., and Andre Iguodala on the team. And if you're thinking he should have played ahead of any of those guys, then you're suggesting that the wisdom of Kerr's rotation and that it won a title, what, it could have been easier to win a title if Moody was in it? I don't know where the logic comes. Those guys were in the rotation ahead of Moody as a rookie, and they won a championship, an unexpected one. Last year, it was Clay, Steph, Poole, and Dante DiVincenzo. Now, I've heard complaints that Kerr played Anthony Lamb and Ty Jerome and that their minutes should have gone to Kuminga and Moody. But the reality is, Jerome shot it better than Moody. Lamb was always in the right place defensively, even if he didn't have the athleticism. that Kuminga had, because Kuminga's athleticism wasn't making up for him not being in the right place. Jerome was also not only a better shooter than Moody, but he was a backup playmaker, something that Moody simply is not. Lamb was a bigger body and a better defender, and what Moody did best, which is shoot, was simply not a need. And what Kuminga did, I'm not sure what his best attribute was prior to this year. Now they've been finding ways to unleash that athleticism, and his scoring is impressive. He's got a lot of different ways to score, especially when he attacks the rim. But if you're going to give the guy the ball as much as they did the other night, and you're playing the San Antonio Spurs, and he gets numbers, and you don't win, what is that telling you about that style of play and how successful it can be? And all you can say, well, you just need to give him more games. That's one game. How many games can you afford to spend when you're the Golden State Warriors? And at the same time, I hear people saying, well, they can't waste Stephen Curry's last years. They got to make the most of those. Okay, so which is it? Because you can't have both. You want to develop Kuminga? You want to let him go through the growing pains and force feed him the ball? Okay. But that's not going to work if you're trying to maximize chasing one more championship with Steph Curry.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Now, as I said, this year, Kerr has admitted there were times he should have played Moody more. And I'll say this too. This is what I suspect is one of the reasons that he didn't. With role players, coaches love hustle plays. Grabbing an extra rebound, deflecting a pass, making a steal. The kind of things that Brandon Podziemski and Gary Payton II do. And it's a bit of a surprise when they do it too, just because of their size or their speed. It looks as if, man, this guy's just doing it on all heart. And Moody, I suspect, suffers from being smooth. It's not his fault, but he is a graceful athlete. And I've seen this other places, other times with other athletes. It doesn't always look like he's working as hard as other guys. And I'm not saying he isn't. I'm just saying it doesn't look like it because of how graceful he is. And I've seen other guys pay the tax, the graceful tax, and not be looked at in the same way. Or the feeling is, that guy's not working hard. He may be working hard. He's smooth. He doesn't look rushed. He doesn't look hectic. And having talked to enough coaches and watched what they respond to, and having coached a bit myself, I can tell you that when a guy is flying around and playing above his size, a coach is going to let him stay out there longer for the energy he brings to the team, the example that he's setting. Look at this little guy from the end of the bench who's just running around getting it done. How about the rest of you following his lead? And that's what Kerr did as a player. He scratched and clawed to defend bigger opponents so that Phil Jackson or Greg Popovich would keep him on the floor to be a floor spacer at the other end. But the only way he was going to get those minutes and get his shots was to be absolutely ready, not knowing when the ball was going to be swung to him, but being on point and ready to fire when it did come his way. And not giving up in the meantime, not giving up easy buckets at the other end, which for someone who was 6'2", 6'3", 185 pounds, not particularly fast, it was all just being scrappy. I'm sure there's some part of Kerr who relates to Payton and Pods more than he does Moody. And Moody does a lot of good things, but being a whirling dervish is not really one of them. There's also this misguided idea when we go to Kerr's just fumbling the bag when it comes to the Warriors overall and what they have. There's this idea that having a great player or multiple stars on a team, that it should win, and that if it doesn't, it must be the coach not utilizing that talent correctly. In the same way that we have teams that don't seem to be particularly talent-laden, and they overachieve, and everybody's like, well, man, great coaching job. You're guessing. You don't know. You don't know because you're not in the locker room. You're not in practice. You don't know. It may be the leadership in the locker room. It may just be the chemistry of that team. It may be the IQ of that team. Coach is contributing. There's no doubt about it. But to what level? Is he the reason that they're different? I mean, we're seeing a little bit of that in Oklahoma City right now with Mark Daigneault. Like, I'm sure he's contributing. That's a very smart, loaded, motivated team with not very high expectations. So there's not pressure on them. They're overachieving in a massive way. That's a good place to be, at least until you get to the playoffs. And so, look, sometimes it's true. The coach is utilizing the talent correctly or incorrectly, as the case may be. And generally, the latter happens when a head coach isn't holding the stars accountable. Sometimes it's because he and his staff aren't adept at making in-game decisions. There's a big difference between a coach who's really good at preparing a team and a coach who can see matchups, can see changes in momentum, can see how to shift the game by making adjustments in the course of a game. Very few coaches are able to do both. They're generally really good at one or the other. They can create sets that play to their stars' strengths and minimize their weaknesses. That's one in terms of preparation. But in-game, who to go to, how to switch things up, sensing the momentum, sensing a weakness and how to exploit it on the other team, that's a whole other animal. And there are also instances where the coach isn't empowered to have the stars do his bidding, or he doesn't have the personality. I can't help but feel Darvin Ham, with the Lakers, has to tap dance around what LeBron wants to do. And because of the player that Darvin was in his career, there's probably a part of him that is intimidated by the stars that he has on his team, because they accomplished so much more than he did. And the only way you get over that as a coach is if you are a tactician to the nth degree and you've spent time developing that. Darvin has, as an assistant coach, he's put his time in and he understands the game. He also understands the intangibles of how teams work. He's way smarter than you think he is. But there's still the personality and the background question. He doesn't have five rings the way Kerr does. Another example, Ime Udoka has been more effective in Houston, first because he was bequeathed a couple of no-nonsense vets in Jeff Green and Fred VanVleet that came in with him, but also because he has a far more demanding no-nonsense personality than his predecessor, Steven Silas. It's not at all that Silas didn't know what the young Rockets needed to do. He just couldn't get Kevin Porter Jr. and Jalen Green and Christian Wood to do it. The Rockets moved Wood, Porter Jr., Udoka let Green know, Jalen Green that is, know that Van Vliet would be running the offense and they'd be playing through Alperen Sengun because he was just all around better than Jalen. And Jalen was going to have to earn his minutes and shots. Green's offensive numbers under Udoka aren't appreciably different versus his 2 years under Silas. What's different is that he's playing harder and more effectively on defense and rebounding the ball better. And those X-factor elements are what have led to Houston already having 6 more wins with 19 games to go than they had in any of the previous 3 seasons. But sometimes it's not the coach. It's that those stars, the names might be the same, the games are not. They may still even get comparable numbers. But you have to watch the games to see if they are getting those numbers the same way or at the same points in the game. And why is when they score important or rebound, whatever it might be? Because there are times throughout 48 minutes when a good player knows he can get busy and rack up some numbers. Why do you think LeBron took the first three shots in the second quarter against the Denver Nuggets the night he was gunning for 40,000 points? Because Nikola Jokic and Aaron Gordon were on the bench to start the second quarter. He had Najee Marshall and Peyton Watson and Michael Porter Jr. to drive on, and he did. But were those points going to win the game? And I'm not picking on LeBron here. Any smart, capable player knows how to get stats if that's what their primary focus is. But does it fit the game plan? Is that where their energy is best utilized? The fact that somebody can score against the second unit at the beginning of the second quarter, and again, it's not with LeBron, it's just like any player. There's plenty of players, good players on bad teams, and if you really look closely at when they get their numbers, if they're getting their numbers against the second unit and they're just kind of getting by against the first unit, that tells you a lot. There's generally a huge difference between starters and the bench, at least beyond the first guy off the bench. Is the threat that player, that star posing, is it creating opportunities for their teammates? Or is the opponent content to let them get their individual numbers, believing that they can't get enough of them to win the game? Can't help but think that some of that was what was going on with D'Angelo Russell and the Lakers against the Bucks. They're like, well, D'Lo can score, but he's not going to win the game for them. We can eke this out. And I was shocked, honestly, that Doc Rivers never made a defensive adjustment that I can see. Just rode that to the end. And maybe I shouldn't be shocked because we've seen that before. And I believe that's his downfall when it comes to losing 3-1 series. Once the opposing coach figures out something that is going to force Doc to make an adjustment, he seems to be very reluctant to do that. Or either that, or his players are not making the adjustment and he never calls them out. I've never heard him do that. And that may keep him in good stead with the players, but I don't know that that builds a team, a championship team. Now, I have read that Darvin Ham and the Lakers are wasting LeBron's final years, as if he's the same LeBron and they're just not giving him enough help. But why do you think they're practically the same team when he doesn't play? Because Rui Hachimura can get opportunistic buckets. D'Angelo Russell, allowed to dominate the ball, can score 40 points on a given night. And if you're wondering why they can't get big nights from Rui and D'Lo when LeBron plays, it's because they're feeding from the same trough. And that's not how it was when LeBron was at his best. Now, Darvin Ham isn't going to tell LeBron, hey, I don't need you getting the easy buckets. I need you getting the hard buckets. I need you saving your energy for that. I need you to save your energy and give me a little more defensively. I need you to rebound a little harder and get back after a miss, not complain to the refs and leave us with a 5-on-4. Which to this point, I don't know that Darvin, I've seen any indication that Darvin has told LeBron to do that. And what do you think would happen if Darvin did? Steve Kerr, on the other hand, is willing to get on his stars. He will say to Steph in a film session, what the bleep was that? I've been told. He will. And everybody was waiting around because they're watching the film and Steph clearly messes something up. And everybody's waiting. Is Steve going to say something or is he going to let it go? Because that's the way a lot of teams work. The coach will not get on the star player. He'll yell at the sub who made the same mistake as his way of getting that message to the star. But he won't confront him directly. Steve Kerr will. He will tell Draymond he's got to be smarter about his engagement with the refs. And he will tell the public, Draymond needs to be smarter about his engagement with the refs. He will tell Klay his shot selection has to improve, and he will bring him off the bench when it doesn't. All of that about Steve Kerr is taken for granted by those who want him fired or don't think he's a very good coach. It sounds simple, but how many other coaches are doing those things? I mean, coaches with established multi-champion players. Eric Spoelstra will do it. Greg Popovich will do it. Mike Malone, I believe, will do it, is that kind of guy. But it gets real thin after that. You're talking about 4 or 5 coaches in the league. Steve Kerr happens to be one of them. And you want to get rid of him. What is that? We'll take it as I said, just a neurological blip, a mistake, a gaffe. We all make them at various times. We have theories or ideas, emotionally driven. We throw them out there, and we don't want to take them back, especially if whatever's annoying us continues. You can find a scapegoat for why the Warriors are where they are, but Steve Kerr ain't it. All right, that does it for this episode of On the Ball on the United WeCast Network. Please rate and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And in the next episode, well, we're coming down into the home stretch, and I'm seeing a change in how the game is being officiated. And there's certain teams that I would expect are going to benefit greatly from that. Is this a harbinger of where we're going? Is it a course correction by the league because everything was so touchy-feely prior to the All-Star break? I may get into all that in the next episode. We also have, it's almost that time, we need to start filling out ballots. And I've already got an idea of who I want to give or who I'm going to vote for the season awards. And some of the names may surprise some of you, because they're not the ones that are getting the most attention. May have to get to that. I will get to that at some point. I just don't know if it'll be in the next episode. In the meantime, as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.